and you are listening to Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. 70 years ago, the ancient town of Guernica in northern Spain was bombed to bits by German planes allied with General Francisco Franco. The sordid history of the carpet bombing of undefended civilian areas had reached a new stage. How had this come to be? Why did Guernica become an international symbol? And what kinds of social fears and anxieties did it play upon? How did writers and artists, including Picasso, try and give voice to the horror of aerial bombardment and the idea of sudden, overwhelming attack? And why were efforts to ban the bombing by air of non-military targets, why were these efforts defeated, with tragic consequences for millions of unarmed civilians? These and other questions are taken up by Ian Patterson, in a fascinating new book entitled Guernica and Total War. Ian Patterson teaches English literature at Queen's College, Cambridge. He joins us now by phone from his office at Cambridge University. Welcome, Ian.
Hello.
Hi. So what prompted or motivated you to write this book?
Well, I think it was a combination of several things, plus the invitation to write a book in a series. I've been interested in the Spanish Civil War for a number of years, and I'd been interested in the appalling nature of bombing for as long as I can remember. And the opportunity seemed to present itself to think a bit more deeply about why bombing, particularly the bombing of Guernica, had had the impact it had, and how it was, how people had responded to it, and why it was that it, although it never seems to work very well, everybody seems so entirely wedded to continuing to use it as a strategy in war.
Before we talk about, I guess it's Guernica, the town in northern Spain in the 1930s, give us a very brief primer about the Spanish Civil War. The two main sides in this war that began in 1936 were the Republican government, the government of Spain, and the right-wing nationalist forces of General Francisco Franco. What's important to know about these two sides?
Well, I think it's important to know that Spain was very volatile still. There had been a kind of jockeying for position between a very traditional, conservative, religious right and a move to try and democratize the country, in which everybody from middle-of-the-road liberals to communist revolutionaries were involved. And in 1936, not for the first time, a government of a fairly liberal, left-liberal government was elected, which was bent on doing a few things like secularizing education, giving greater rights to workers and to women, which the conservative forces who finally gathered under Franco and the armed forces were very much opposed to. They thought this would mean the end of Spain as they knew it. They thought it would mean the end of the Spanish traditions and the relation between the landowners and the church. And they were probably frightened that things would get worse than they ever would have done. But nonetheless, they weren't prepared to put up with the legally elected government. And so on the 16th, 17th, 18th of July, there was an uprising led by the army, first of all, from North Africa, and a carefully prepared number of uprisings in barracks across the country, which plunged the country into civil war until the defeat of the Republicans finally in the spring of 1939.
3 years of civil war, and Guernica, the town in northern Spain in the Basque country, played a prominent role in that war and in international perceptions of that war and of bombing of civilians in general. Tell us about Guernica and the town and what it represented. What kind of a place was it before it was bombed?
It was a tiny little town. A hilltop town in northwest Spain. It had been for hundreds of years the sacred town, the capital town of the Basque people, a people who, although they'd been part of Spain, had a fierce tradition of independence and wanted to be more independent. And for many, many centuries, they had had a tradition of a kind of parliamentary democracy, government by parliament, who would settle under the oak tree, the famous symbolic oak tree of Guernica, the disputes and the disagreements that would be brought to them for settlement. And this small town, no longer by the 20th century really anything other than the symbolic capital of that area, with big towns like Bilbao taking over, but still having that tremendous symbolic capital, had no other real importance. It was a market town. It was a country market town. It had a population of a few thousand. It had no military installations in the town, and it wasn't even fortified or defended. It happened to be near the retreating line of the Spanish Republican Army, and the commander, General Mola, the commander of the Spanish forces in the area, threatened. He dropped leaflets from airplanes threatening to destroy the whole of the Basque country and to raise it to the ground and to destroy the city of Bilbao. And partly, I think, getting the Condor Legion to bomb Guernica was a sort of a warning, a threat, to show that something like that could be done.
In other words, the threat realized, either you surrender or we'll bomb you... will obliterate you, and in fact they did. And let's talk, because you spend some time in this book, about what actually happened to Guernica on Monday, April 26th, 1937. What happened to the people and the buildings, the livestock?
Well, there were a lot of livestock, first of all, because it was the market day, and it wasn't just a food market, it was a livestock market as well. And people brought their produce in ox carts and on horseback and muleback and so on. So there were plenty of animals around. But the town was also quite full of people, being market time. And late in the afternoon, first of all, a single bomber appeared and circled round and went away again. And then flights of bombers appeared and started suddenly, without warning, to drop bombs in the square in front of the station. And this went on for a while, and there were a number of people killed and other casualties and destruction and a great deal of panic. But nothing happened after that for about half an hour. And then a huge number, wave after wave of bombers came, and they just dropped bombs for about an hour, killing very large numbers of people, and nobody knows exactly how many, and destroying a lot of buildings. And then most of the buildings were wood-framed and built of wood with infill, so that when the next wave of bombers started dropping new incendiary bombs, this town, which was, it was a nice spring day, everything was quite dry, the town started to burn. The combination of high explosive and incendiary bombs spread even more panic. People in the air raid shelters sometimes were unable to get out. Burning was all around. The city, the flames of the city burning could be seen 15, 20 miles away. And as people ran from the town itself, the dive bombers came in and started shooting with tracer bullets. And they, as a kind of sport, really, they shot to death many of the people who were running away from the town. Indeed, when they finished with the people and there were no more people they could find to shoot, they shot the sheep. And a very moving description of 2,000 dead sheep lying in the fields the next morning. And the most extraordinary thing about this, given that it took place in the Spanish Civil War, was that the bombing was carried out very largely by German planes.
Yeah, you mentioned the Condor Legion.
It was a German squadron, entirely German, led by von Richthofen, who had been a famous war ace in the First World War, led by von Richthofen, and all the technicians and the support staff were German. And there were also some aircraft crude by Italians sent by Mussolini in the bombing fleet as well. No Spaniards were involved. It was entirely mercenary as an activity.
And you're right. You're right that Nazi Germany was not deeply interested in the Spanish Civil War. So why did Hitler end up providing significant military assistance to Franco, including the squadron that bombed Guernica?
Well, partly because he wanted to make sure that he could get hold of a number of important minerals that came from northern Spain that were important for the German arms industry and for the manufacture of bombs and the like. Partly because he thought it was a good idea to keep the Civil War going as long as possible while Germany continued to rearm. It occupied the Soviet Union a bit. And partly because, on the whole, Franco was a potential ally of Hitler and Mussolini and the Axis powers. And although Franco was nominally neutral, Spain was nominally neutral in the Second World War, there was a good deal of assistance and traffic between Spain and Germany. So I think although Spain had no major importance to Hitler, it was thought on the whole that it would be better to have them on their side than not. And they were useful.
You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Ian Patterson is our guest today. He's the author of the new book, Guernica and Total War, recently out from Harvard University Press. He's also author of a book of poems entitled Time to Get Here. He's published numerous translations, including of Finding Time Again. That's the final volume of Proust's In Search of Lost Time. He joins us by phone from his office at Cambridge University. We have a link to his latest book, Guernica and Total War, on our website, againstthegrain.org. And although the word is really not pronounced Guernica in Spanish, I've chosen to stick with the common pronunciation, what people, listeners, will understand. So, Ian, you've kind of begun to talk about what was unprecedented about the bombing of Guernica. What happened there that really hadn't happened before, or hadn't happened to that scale, in that scale before in warfare?
What happened there was that a town was destroyed. Almost completely, very few buildings left standing, and a very large number of completely innocent and unconnected civilians lost their lives and their livelihoods and their houses. It was the scale of the destruction that was so so novel, and the fact that it came completely out of the blue, unexpectedly, and against an undefended, unfortified, and indeed non-military target.
And I think you mentioned in this book the number of casualties, correct? You said something like, well, first of all, there were maybe 5,000 to 7,000 residents of Guernica, and then since it was market day, or I think maybe since refugees had come into the town, there were maybe 10,000. How many people actually died and how many were injured, according to best estimates?
Well, the best estimates at the time put the figures at about just under 1,500. There have been a certain number of revisions lately downwards from that. But there's really no way of knowing exactly how many. I would have thought the bottom estimate would be 500 and the top would have been about 1,400. A very high proportion of the people who were there.
And here we get to part of the title of your book, Guernica and Total War. What does total war mean, and how important was the bombing of Guernica to it?
Well, total war, essentially, is different from previous forms of warfare in that it involves the whole population, and it makes of the whole population part of the target or part of the enemy. It's no longer appropriate to have a complete distinction between combatants and non-combatants, because the bombing of civilians is part of the new war project. So total war is a war that is waged against the totality of a society with the totality of weaponry available to the aggressor.
Giulio Duhay, or Duhet, he was an Italian soldier, a novelist, and a poet. What did he argue about the power of air-based warfare?
He was a very interesting guy and a bit of a fantasist, but he seized on the idea of air warfare immediately and thought that the greater the amount of bombs you could drop, the more total would be the demoralization of those on whom they fell. His view was that if you could drop enough high explosive quickly enough, then the government would immediately sue for peace because it would destroy completely the morale of the civilian population. Nobody would be able to stand up to it. Everybody would panic. Government would collapse. Civil systems would collapse. And so the Air Force, which could do that first and most effectively, would be the one that would win the war and win it very quickly. He imagined that wars would go on for 2 or 3 or 4 days.
And tell us more about what a breakdown of civilian morale, in his opinion, would lead to in terms of social disorder.
Well, he did see it very much in terms of social disorder. He thought that, I think he had a very hierarchical view of how societies operated, and that if you hit the command centers, if you destroyed the cities, then you destroyed the nerve center of civilization itself. People would respond with panic. They would run away. They would loot. They would maraud. They would steal. They would fight each other. They would generally revert to an almost animal state. He thought that civilization itself was sufficiently frail that if serious aerial bombardment was directed at a city or a town, the inhabitants would be unable to cope, that their morale and their morality would break down absolutely, and the country would no longer be governable.
Well, I guess one question then to ask is whether his conclusions, his contentions in books like The Command of the Air, whether his arguments were in fact supported by evidence.
They were stimulated by the opposite of evidence, by the sort of the things he'd read in the stories of H.G. Wells. The evidence, such as it was, has always been to the opposite effect. People don't like being bombed, and they get very, very cross. And instead of running away, they stand and shake their fists at the airplanes, and they reconstruct, and they dig in. And they determined not to be swayed from what they were doing before. There is very little evidence of any serious moral, as they would have said, moral degeneration as a result of bombing. Even when the colonial air forces in the 1920s used to drop relatively small bombs on relatively small villages in Africa and the Middle East, they had surprisingly little effect on the people underneath.
Okay, so if this man, Duhet, if he then argued that aerial bombardment of civilian targets would destroy civilian morale, leading to a breakdown in the social order, and these arguments were not based on solid evidence, why did his ideas persist?
Now, that's a very interesting question. I mean, this is a question which is at the heart of what really interests me. I think the simple answer is that people don't act on evidence. There was a fantastically widespread belief that bombing would have this result, and it was backed up by novels like Amy. It was created by, before bombing was even a possibility, by science fiction novelists like Jules Verne and H.G. Wells and others. And despite the lack of evidence, the power of the idea seems to have taken over, really. it seems to have become a more real thing as an idea than as something that actually happened. So that you read books about what would happen in the event of bombing, and people don't look at what happened very much in the First World War, where there was plenty of evidence of people not running away from Zeppelin bombs in Britain. What they did instead was to rely on the fear they felt within themselves and the way that related to imagined predictions and imagined fictional depictions of cataclysmic aerial bombardment.
Give us an example.
Well, I suppose the best example would be the influence of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, or Things to Come. The idea that the world could be destroyed, or most of it could be destroyed, in a matter of a day or two by either an alien invasion or an enemy air fleet. And for hundreds of years thereafter, a kind of savagery would reign, out of which eventually some new civilization, rather an authoritarian one in most visions, might emerge. But there are, in fact, hundreds of books, popular fiction books, at this time in a variety of languages, which use variations on this theme as the center of their novel.
Ian Paterson joins us today on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We're talking about his latest book, just out from Harvard University Press. It's entitled Guernica and Total War. We have links to his book on our website, againstthegrain.org, where you can also go to download podcasts of our programs. My name is C.S. Song. And as you indicate in this book, Ian, aerial bombardment had happened during the First World War, and certainly the notion that people were defenseless against bombardment from the sky, that there was no adequate protection against aerial attacks, certainly this must have had some impact on popular anxieties.
It did have impact on popular anxieties, and it had impact, I think, in two ways. The first was that a number of people thought, this is a bad thing to do. It is immoral to do this because of the way that it can just happen to people, the way that bombs can destroy people without warning and without possibility of defense. And the other thing that, the other effect it had was that people started to think about how to defend themselves from it to the extent that they could. The first air raid shelters appear. People during bombing raids in the First World War in London use the underground railway, the tube, just as they did in the Second World War.
They hid down there.
They hid down there. They sheltered down there. And it sparked off a pretty extensive debate about the morality of bombing, but not one that obviously that had a tremendous impact on those who were in charge of things, particularly people like Churchill, who were quite in favor of it.
Yeah, although you write that efforts were made to create rules that would restrict aerial bombing only to certain situations, or perhaps altogether, what happened to these efforts? Who was behind them, and what was their fate?
Well, there were two. And there was an early movement, as soon as, even before aerial bombardment started, there were moves to limit it. And these were intensified after the First World War. They were supported by, on the whole, by international diplomats and pacifists, and for two separate reasons. The pacifists, for the obvious reason that they wanted to do all they could to prevent that sort of thing. International diplomats, because they wanted to make sure that they didn't get outflanked, which is usually the diplomatic rationale. And there were a number of conferences in the course of the 1920s and a number of organizations devoted to this. And these led up to international conferences at the League of Nations in Geneva, where most of the major nations of the world were represented, and there were motions put forward to not only to limit bombardment of civilian populations, but to end it altogether. And it's conceivable that such a motion might have been agreed, that bombing might have been outlawed, at least for a while, had the British not vetoed it. The other thing that was going on was that there were quite powerful movements towards the idea of an air police force, an international air police. This was an idea that Churchill was keen on for a while, but that also foundered as international cooperation became increasingly difficult in the early 1930s.
Ian Patterson teaches English at Cambridge University. He joins us by phone from Cambridge, the UK, and we're talking about his book, Guernica and Total War. We will take a short break, and then I want to ask Ian about a number of other very interesting things in his book, including the propaganda around the bombing, post-bombing. The nationalists, the Francoists and their sympathizers claimed that they did not, or their German allies did not, in fact, bomb Guernica. We'll also talk about claims about the preciseness, the accuracy of bombing, precision bombing in modern parlance, and whether those claims back then were correct. I also want to ask him what Bertrand Russell and even Sigmund Freud had to say about civilization, aggression, machines, and the dangers of a new mentality around machines. Please stay with us.